This is your community radio station, 88.3 Southern FM.
The BINAR space program is a space research and education group in the Space Science and Technology Centre at Perth's Curtin University. The name BINAR comes from the Noongar word for fireball. Well, they made Western Australia's first satellite, BINAR 1. This mission report shows that making and operating even a small satellite is quite demanding and complex.
The BINAR 1 mission primary objective was to demonstrate the custom-designed systems made by PhD students and engineers at the university. The main technology being demonstrated was the integrated BINAR CubeSat core, which compacted the electrical power system, attitude determination and control system, and flight computer system into a volume of a quarter of a liter. Alongside this, the team also aimed to learn about end-to-end spacecraft mission design and engage with the public to build an understanding of the importance of space industry and research in the country. BINAR 1 was deployed from the International Space Station's Kibo module on the 6th of October 2021 and initially was silent for 15 days until the BINAR team was able to make contact by enabling a secondary beacon. The main objectives of the BINAR 1 mission were to demonstrate the custom-designed systems created by the BINAR space program, educate staff and students about end-to-end spacecraft mission design, and spread awareness about the importance of a space sector in Western Australia. Alongside these objectives, the CubeSat was also flown with two secondary payloads, an undergraduate student-led star tracker and a high-resolution Earth imagery camera. The two cameras were both commercially available cameras, the first being selected by the BINAR team to give the best resolution for Earth imagery in the available payload space, and the other being a low-resolution camera that was selected from a range of cameras tested by the team of undergraduate students. Deployed from the ISS at approximately 5:20 p.m. Australian Western Standard Time on the 6th of October of 2021, BINAR 1 was required to wait 30 minutes before deploying its antennas and starting to beacon. The first possible attempt at receiving from the ground station in Western Australia was expected at approximately 11 p.m. However, the team also planned to use the SatNOGS 4 service to look for signals earlier. The beacon string contained the satellite name, GPS data, critical power and temperature information, and a unique message from the BINAR team. Unfortunately, no communications were received on the first pass or on any of the SatNOGS passes. This prompted the team to start attempting to communicate with the satellite and search the sky for its location. However, these attempts soon ended as the other two CubeSats launched along with BINAR 1, Maya 3, and Maya 4 successfully established contact within the first day of operations, successfully confirming the expected location of BINAR 1. As such, this prompted the team to start a failure mode analysis to determine if a recovery could be made. A benefit of the BINAR 1 custom design was the knowledge of the system available to the team. By stepping through how the satellite would behave after deployment, the team was able to closely analyze the possible operation paths and determine if any possible software bugs or hardware failures could have caused the communication silence. First, the 30-minute wait must occur after deployment where the communication system is powered off. After the 30 minutes, the communication system is powered on and the antenna's deployment circuit will activate if the satellite has over 50% battery. The deployment burn wires will be switched on until the successful deployment condition is met or until the 10-minute timeout is reached. If the battery is less than 50%, then the satellite will wait for 24 hours before attempting the deployment. After this, the bootloader makes two system checks before deciding to boot into application code or safe mode. The first check is the system critical checks. This check will scan the system flags for any reported faults. These flags are only set in the system critical check application in application mode or in safe mode. This means that during the first boot, this check will always pass. The other check that is performed is a check on the antenna deployment condition. If the antennas did not deploy correctly, then the CubeSat would be put into safe mode, where a beacon would be broadcast at reduced frequency to conserve power. This is where a software logic error was found, as when the timers are enabled, and if the antennas didn't deploy within 255 seconds, then the communication system would not be configured properly. To test that the error existed, the team performed a test with the engineering model and verified that this was a possibility for failure on Binar 1. Another theorized possibility is that the antenna did deploy correctly and boot into the Flash application software operation mode. In the application mode, the communication system would have been configured again. However, the theory was put forward that the poorly tested adapter board that had a last-minute modification had failed. Due to the nature of the last-minute modification, the board was not thermal vacuum tested or vibration tested correctly, which could have caused a solder joint to break, meaning that the flight computer was potentially not able to communicate with the communication system or power it. Fortunately for the Binar team, if the communication system was powered and in its default mode, it could be configured from the ground. As a result, the team concluded that the best action would be to attempt to send the configuration commands to the satellite and see if the beacon could be received. After first confirming with the engineering model that this was possible, the team attempted to communicate with the communication system, hoping that the adapter board was operating correctly. To attempt the recovery, first the team attempted to configure the communication system in the required mode for the safe mode beacon to be received. These attempts were made over multiple passes to no success. It is still unclear to the team on whether commands were received by the satellite or not, as it depended on how many of the antennas were deployed, the attitude of the satellite during the passes, and if the adapter board was operating properly. With these attempts not being successful, the team decided to attempt to put the communication system into its own beacon mode. This beacon mode was built into the system and could be configured in a similar way to the desired configuration. The attempts to enable this mode were successful on the first attempt, partially recovering the location and status of Binar 1. The first beacon was received at approximately 5:21 p.m. on the 21st of October, almost exactly 15 days after the deployment from the ISS. The beacons enabled were operating with a shorter period and lower bit rate to try and help the team to locate the satellite. The beacons were seen for another 11 and a half days until Binar 1 made its final recorded transmission at approximately 7:03 a.m. on the 2nd of November. Although the team made many attempts to recover the satellite again after this date, it is suspected that the satellite ran out of charge at this point due to a combination of the compromised power budget and constant power cycling, causing startup applications to run regularly. The power cycling could be observed as the message contained in the beacon would revert to the default message. Another observation that was made was the bitrate of the beacons not being reconfigured when the power cycle occurred. This led the team to believe that the cause of failure was likely due to the adapter board. From the failure analysis, the team believes that the last-minute adapter board modification was the cause of the lost communications with the flight computer. This belief comes from the beacon bitrate not being reset when the communication system was being power cycled, suggesting that the connection between the flight computer and the transceiver were not made correctly and likely broke during vibration testing, launch, or when exposed to the environment of space. Although only a partial recovery was made, the Binar team was still able to infer some of the operations of the BCC from the beacon mode activated on the transceiver. It was clear to the team that the EPS was able to power the BCC until the final communication was made. Knowing the power budget problem before launch, it is clear to the team that the solar panels, MPPTs, batteries, battery heaters, and the distribution subsystems were operational to some extent. The flight computer was also operating as expected as it was turning the communication system on. Alongside these two systems, there was also valuable knowledge gained about the deployment switches and the performance of the structure during launch and in space. All of this could only be learnt by the team by delivering the mission.
And Bynar 1 entered the Earth's atmosphere and burnt up in 2022 October. Following this failure, the Bynar team pressed on with making another three satellites to be called Bynar 2, 3 and 4. In April, they were sent to the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency to be prepared for an expected launch to the International Space Station. That launch happened on August the 4th this year as a payload aboard the Cygnus NG-21 cargo craft that was lofted by a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket from Florida. The Cygnus NG-21 is named SS Scobie in honour of astronaut Dick Scobie, one of the seven people who died on the STS-51L mission in 1986. At the time of the launch, it was stated that the three Bynar satellites will be deployed from the Kibo module at a date yet to be determined, probably in September. Well, that September has now arrived. Now, each Bynar contains has a volume of 1 cubic decimeter. Or in if it was liquid, it would be a litre. The mission objectives include the exploration of the operation of an Australian-built constellation of satellites. This includes validation of the Bynar platform demonstrating a resilient system in a space environment. The new satellites have an upgrade from the Bynar 1 satellite with more advanced communications. One aim is to demonstrate tracking of surface assets from a CubeSat with radio frequency beacons. A final objective is to explore how the satellites can be shielded from radiation. And this last involves instrumentation provided by CSIRO, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation. Well, on Thursday, August the 29th, United States astronaut Tracy Dyson wrangled seven satellites into a deployer in the Japanese Kibo module of the International Space Station. At 5:45 p.m., the command was sent from Japan to spring eject four of them. They were a Microsat and three CubeSats. As the quartet drifted away from the space station, Dyson photographed them and sent the photograph to the ground. NASA Public Affairs grabbed one of these photographs and published it on their website as Picture of the Day. Meanwhile, in Japan, preparations were being made to get the Japanese Aerospace Agency's small satellite orbital deployer for release of the three Bynar satellites. Here's the report on that deployer.
JAXA's GEM, Small Satellite Orbital Deployer, JSOD. The Japanese experiment module Kibo on the ISS. This project is conducted by JAXA, utilizing Kibo's distinct function of having both an airlock and a robotic arm. JAXA has provided many opportunities to universities, space emerging nations, private companies to deploy satellites. A standard one-unit microsatellite, CubeSat, is 10 centimeters square in size. JSOD can meet various needs by accommodating one-unit to wide six-unit CubeSats and up to a 50-kilogram-sized microsat. It is possible to load up to 12 one-unit satellites at the same time. In addition, to meet increasing demand, JAXA has developed a new deployment case, JSOD-R. JSOD-R can be used repeatedly and can release up to 6-unit satellites in a slot. Satellites are deployed using a powerful spring attached on JSOD cases. Satellites are launched into low Earth orbit for approximately 1 year. Let's see how satellites are transported to space and launched into orbit. User satellites are handed over to JAXA and carefully installed in a case. The case is wrapped with cushioning material and stowed in the cargo transfer bag. Compared to conventional rocket-mounted launches, this method drastically mitigates launch vibration, which contributes to reducing satellite development cost. After the cargo transporter reaches the ISS, the crew receive the satellite cargo transfer bag and conduct JSOD setup on board Kibo. The JSOD case is installed on the airlock slide table. As for JSOD-R, astronauts will load the satellites in orbit. The case is transferred outboard using Kibo's airlock and robotic arm, a unique dual function possessed only by Kibo. The Kibo Mission Control Room on ground conducts this operation. Developers and participants gathered at the Scuba Space Center watch in anticipation as the robotic arm is set to the releasing point.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6.
A command is sent from the ground. Release. Since 2012, JAXA has been providing deployment opportunities to universities, private companies, many domestic and foreign users who do not have the capacity to do so. In addition, JAXA is cooperating with the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs and University Space Engineering Consortium to enhance social and international contribution. The world is entering a next space age, and the number of JSOD users is steadily increasing. Creative user ideas can extend the possibilities and value of low Earth orbit utilization, and JAXA continuously supports the pursuit of new possibilities.
In Western Australia, the Bonar team gathered to watch a live stream telecast from Japan and the International Space Station as the release of the three Bonar CubeSats approached. Dr. Fergus Downey is the program manager.
Bonar 2, 3 and 4 succeed our first mission, West Australia's first satellite, Bonar 1. Since the mission, the Bonar technology platform has been enhanced and now supports some of the world's most advanced 1U CubeSats. The Bonar 2, 3 and 4 mission comprises collaborations with industry and the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation to augment Australia's sovereign space capabilities and research output.
Meg Berry is the program coordinator.
In keeping with the Bonar space program's goals of increasing access to space for Western Australians, the Bonar X outreach program empowers WA high school students to design and build payloads for low Earth orbit on board future CubeSat missions. To achieve this, we've designed a removable payload bay to standardize payload opportunities for students and researchers alike.
Jacob Cook is a space system engineer.
Bonar 2, 3 and 4 carry diverse payloads, including a prototype S-band radio developed by AVI, an undergraduate star tracker and an in-house developed radiation sensor testing CSIRO's new radiation shielding material. We've also developed the Bonar low-speed transceiver that will utilise amateur radio frequencies and allow us to work with the amateur radio community to bring a Capture Our Satellite competition to life.
Kyle McMillan is a PhD student.
A novel technology developed for Bonar 2 through 4 is our flexible deployable solar panels, integral to my PhD research. These incorporate shape memory alloy strips for controlled deployment, supporting the use of high-powered payloads.
Nick Rogers handles launch operations and the legal side of things.
We extend our gratitude to our launch partner, SpaceBD, and the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency for their continued support of our missions. Minasan arigato gozaimasu. Our thanks also to the Government of Western Australia for their endorsement and the Commonwealth for entrusting our satellites to proudly fly the Australian flag. The Bonar Space Program is excited to announce Bonar 2, 3, 4 are ready for flight.
About 5 minutes before the satellites were due to be deployed, the controllers in Japan gave a go or no-go call.
This is JAXA Flight Director. We'd like to ask your final go for satellite deployment from Launcher 2. Bonar Space Program, are you ready?
This is Bonar Space Program, and we are ready. Go!
Coffee on, the deployment will be on time.
Tracy Dyson is an astronaut aboard the International Space Station. She handled the satellites and put them into the dispenser in the Japanese module. After the deployment, she had this message for the people in Western Australia.
Congratulations on the successful deployment of BNR 2, 3, and 4. I heard those satellites are the successor of BNR 1 deployed in 2021. BNR Space Program team from Curtin University, I hope for the success of your mission.
That release came at 9:20 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. That was 7:20 in Western Australia. For quite some time, there was vision of the trio drifting away from the space station. The question was, would they work? Well, a few days ago, Curtin University announced that all three binars had activated their radio beacons and signals were received at the Western Australian ground station. To follow on this series of satellites, binar 5, 6 and 7 are planned for a future deployment from the International Space Station. And if all goes to plan, in 2027 or 2028, a 12 cubic decimeter size satellite will be launched. Called Binar Explorer, this will demonstrate in Earth orbit the technology for lunar orbit insertion.
Binar Prospector is a geophysical survey mission from Western Australia's Curtin University to identify lunar resources from orbit. The Binar Prospector mission will comprise two lunar orbiters. The spacecraft will host a thermal infrared imaging camera and a magnetometer. These payloads are designed to deliver a deeper understanding of the geology of the Moon, identify mineralization, and localized accessible ice deposits. To obtain high-resolution data, the spacecraft will make extremely low, 20-kilometer altitude passes over the lunar surface, delivering a magnetic survey with 10 times current resolution over targets of interest. Binar Prospector will take advantage of the new opportunity for rideshare to the Moon and leverage the real potential of CubeSats, doing one job well in an environment that is not optimal for larger spacecraft. The mission will validate an interplanetary-class small spacecraft platform that can be a workhorse for future Australian missions. And it will explore the potential of a radically new mission architecture, focusing on low-altitude data acquisition using inexpensive spacecraft. Prospecting for economic resources requires high-resolution geophysical datasets. Magnetometry is a prerequisite. A high-resolution magnetic survey would provide a deeper understanding of the geology of the Moon and its resource potential, but the current Global Lunar Magnetic Survey has insufficient resolution to deliver that. In magnetometry, because the field decays with the inverse of distance, better resolution means lower altitude observations. Orbits with low periapsis tend to be unstable, requiring regular maintenance maneuvers and a prohibitive fuel mass burden. Those maneuvers shorten the mission lifetime. For large missions with multiple payloads, this is not optimal. By being the first lunar mission with magnetometers as the primary payload, BNR Prospector will be focused on extreme low-altitude data collection. Our modeling indicates that we can maintain an altitude of 18 plus or minus 9 kilometers with the propulsion system and fuel budget for a nominal mission lifetime of 3 months. BNR Prospector will explore the potential of a radically new mission architecture. While low altitude is a requirement for high-resolution magnetometry, the ability to inexpensively acquire high-value, high-resolution datasets at low altitudes opens up a range of other mission types. Binar Prospector delivers against all objectives of the Moon to Mars initiative for the Australian Space Agency. It will grow the capability and capacity of the Australian space sector whilst also contributing to international efforts to return to the Moon. It will demonstrate to our young student scientists and engineers that the sky is not the limit, and inspire the next generation of Australians to reach for the stars. Launch of the two Binar Prospector satellites is planned for 2030.
Well, it looks like the Curtin University in Perth, Western Australia, is the place to be if you're interested in satellites.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Hey, everybody. Technology is always getting smaller. A computer used to take up an entire room, but now it fits in the palm of your hand. Well, spacecraft aren't all that different. They're traditionally very large and difficult to build, but we're working on ways to miniaturize them. We're going to talk all about that on this episode of Crazy Engineering. Hey everybody, we're here with Andy Klesch in one of JPL's smaller clean rooms. We're building CubeSats in here. Andy, what exactly is a CubeSat?
A CubeSat is really just a standard for a small spacecraft, and we're talking a very small spacecraft, 10 by 10 by 10 centimeters at the smallest on here. And yet they go up to about 30 by 20 by 10 centimeters. And we've launched hundreds into low Earth orbit for the last 10, 15 years.
So this really is in a big contrast to how we normally operate at JPL with our larger clean rooms and our larger spacecraft.
It is. We're trying things a little bit different over here. It's much more rapid development, trying things out with 3D printing and building things up a lot quicker because these missions are a lot smaller.
If I were to build Voyager today, could I miniaturize it? Could I make it really small?
Absolutely not. Voyager has so many different capabilities, and these CubeSats are very, very limited, but they're very focused on what they do, so they can do one thing and do it very, very well.
You're the chief engineer of one of these CubeSat projects. Could you tell us a little bit about the one you're working on?
I work on Marco, or Mars Cube 1.
Can we take a look at the spacecraft?
Absolutely. It's right here.
This looks more like a computer to me than a spacecraft. Can you explain a little bit about how it works?
We have a propulsion system to actually steer us to Mars, a radio to talk back to Earth, and the computer and electronics so that we can actually operate.
So Marco is actually going to Mars?
That's right. We're launching with InSight.
So Marco will travel along with InSight all the way to Mars?
Actually, there are two identical Marco spacecraft, and they'll separate from InSight at Earth. Each spacecraft will then travel to Mars on its own over 6.5 months. Marco's single purpose is to relay data back from InSight during its entry, descent, and landing at Mars. We're really excited about this. It's the first interplanetary CubeSats that we'll have.
What do you see for the future of CubeSats?
Because these are low cost, we see them going to many cool places throughout the solar system. We also see them working together, what we call fractionated space, where the spacecraft is really broken up into all individual instruments, each with a focused task. And together, they're performing the entire mission.
We're hoping to see all kinds of new technology with CubeSats down the road. Andy, thank you so much for showing this to us. Hope you guys had a lot of fun learning about it. Check back soon for some more crazy engineering.
And that crazy engineering worked because those two CubeSats worked brilliantly when they got to Mars.